From KUOW Seattle, it's The Record. I'm Marcy Silman. This weekend, the Port Townsend Film Festival honors the joint career of John Sayles and Maggie Renzi. They released their first indie movie in 1980, The Return of the Secaucus Seven. Since then, John Sayles has been nominated twice for screenwriting Oscars. He's won a MacArthur Genius Award. He has even directed music videos for The Boss, Bruce Springsteen. Maggie Renzi and John Sayles stopped by our studios yesterday on the way to Port Townsend, and Sayles told me his film career really started back when he was a boy in upstate New York.
We didn't live near an indoor theater, so I went to the drive-in with my parents, and my brother and I would be in the back seat. And usually the first feature was, they would start with the cartoons, usually Heckle and Jekyll and Mr. Magoo, before it really got dark enough to see them. And then they would have the Western, which was in color and we liked. And then the second feature was always the man in the gray flannel suit, and we would fall asleep halfway through it. When we made Lone Star, our last scene was actually a scene in a drive-in that we had built. And so we got to see the dailies for a whole week as we were wrapping the whole movie up on a drive-in screen. It was just great.
How did those early Westerns influence your vision for film?
You know, I think I liked the color. I liked any shot with horses crossing water. And I think truly it was that some of them are really well made. And as I see them again, I'm working on a Western now for HBO, I see them again, I realize I had pretty good taste. The ones that I liked the best were actually very well directed, and the story was a little bit better. But I liked them all, you know, even the bad ones.
I'm talking with John Sayles, and with him is Maggie Renzi, and you two have been life and work partners for a while now. Maggie, you were in John's, the first film I saw that John made. I'm not sure if The Return of the Secaucus Seven.
That was the first one.
The first movie. When you met John, was film his vision?
John was a novelist when I met him. Well, an actor when I met him even before in college. We met very briefly in college. We were in the same play, but we didn't have any scenes together. We had a curtain call together. I told him he was really good in the play, and that's all I had to say to him for another 2 years, I guess, when we met again through college friends. He was writing novels then, so I think you had your first novel published the year after we got together, so 1973. And I had been an actress in the Williamstown Summer Theater and also at Williams College, and from when I was a little girl. So I knew a lot about plays. I knew a lot about acting. I didn't know very much about movies.
So how did the idea of making this first movie, 1980, I think, is when the movie
came out. Yeah.
So you probably had the idea a few years before. How do you jump from stage acting novelist to, like, let's make a movie?
I had just started getting some work as a screenwriter in Hollywood and had made a whopping $10,000 a movie because, at that point, Roger Corman, who was the producer of those movies, was signatory to the Writers Guild. And a friend of ours, Jeffrey Nelson, who had run a summer theater that I had acted and directed in, said, you know, we know so many good actors. Why don't we make a movie? You know,
it sounds very Mickey Rooney.
It was exactly.
Hey kids, let's put on a show, which is why, even though I was an actress, as Judy Garland was, I was also a producer, as Mickey Rooney was.
Uncredited.
And I think it was because none of us knew. Now young filmmakers know so much. They have a million books and they can major in college and, you know, they read about it constantly. We made it up as we went along a little bit, like Mickey and Judy.
You guys were indie filmmakers before that term even.
Yeah, right about when people started noticing this phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah. I remember when the films used to sell to Japan, John sitting down with a very earnest Japanese journalist who said, please tell me the difference now between indie movie, cult movie, and midnight movie.
Essentially what you're telling me is you knew how to write scripts, but you guys learned like on the job training how to be filmmakers.
Yeah, we had. I remember what I had was a loose leaf notebook with three hole punch lined paper, and that's how I did my paperwork. Now, of course,
there weren't computers.
No, there were so not computers. Right. Yeah. And of course, people were actually making movies in a much more sophisticated way, but it was in Hollywood, and there was no spillover from Hollywood to what we were doing.
Well, it sounds incredibly romantic and wonderful. What about that
captured you guys.
Talking about individualism, even though I am often the writer, director, and editor of a movie, it really is a kind of communal effort. It's a great thing to do with other people when you're on the same page and you're trying to make the same movie. And if you do it right, people are having fun and they're getting to do stuff that they love to do. Actors really like to act and they would prefer to do it in a movie that they would like to go see.
Technology obviously has changed a lot. The internet makes it pretty cheap to distribute your film, and you don't necessarily have to get it into a theater, though it looks really different. How has the technology and the fact that everybody thinks they're a filmmaker affected you guys moving forward in your film careers?
Well, there's certainly more competition for, you know, if you figure there's X number of screens that play non-Hollywood movies. There are only 52 weeks in the year, so there are only so many play dates. There used to not be that many people competing for those play dates. Now it's like everybody. And the distributors, the few that are left, they don't really have to pay for a movie anymore. They pretty much, you know, feel like, oh, you know, you're really lucky we're going to distribute your movie. And we may not even spend that much on it, but you wouldn't expect an advance or anything, you know, vulgar like that.
Yeah. The number of times that people who I would think would understand how films get made say, I don't see why you can't just keep making movies for $1 million like the kids do. Well, because we pay union wages, because the stories are more sophisticated. What people love about John Sayles movies is they have large ensembles. They're more layered. They're more complex. I think one of the things that happened is that all this homemade kids making movies on cheap gear makes people think that the movies can be cheap. And I think what that will do to us culturally is limit us to these very small beginner stories. My big pitch is if this next generation really wants to be able to make movies, then they need to work hard to get us a secretary for the arts. We need cabinet level representation for National Public Radio, for young filmmakers. The parents who are spending all that money on their kids' super-duper education need that. You have a huge reputation. You have awards. You have nominations, John and Maggie, together. That doesn't help open doors?
It's a pretty bottom-line business. I mean, it is a business. And so if you just recently made a movie or were even associated with a movie that made $100 million, you know, people want to work with you and you know, might put some money into your stuff. Otherwise, it really is, you know, it's like Las Vegas.
You know, you've written and produced movies about baseball playing scandals. You've written about union strikes. You've written the loner stories in the West. You've written stories about aliens who've come down to Earth. What have you not produced that's in your brain that's burning?
Oh, I like most screenwriters, I have four or five screenplays that I've written that I'd love to make, but who knows if I'll ever get to make one. I got to know the Mirapol brothers, who are the sons of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, and I've written a script about, you know, their parents' case. I've written a movie that I might end up having to make into a novel, like my last novel, A Moment in the Sun, was based on a screenplay that I figured I would never get any, you know, money to make. And this one is called Jamie McGillivray, and it starts at the Battle of Culloden and ends at the Battle of Quebec.
Wow.
And so I couldn't make it for under $1 million.
But it's like a Robert Louis Stevenson story. I just finished listening to Treasure Island, and it makes me love Jamie McGillivray all over again. But we'd need $35 million. To make the movie. And that's really what would be fun for me, is to make a big movie.
So that's one thing you haven't done yet.
I would love to do that. To have it, $35 million is not very much for a big movie, but for us, it's big.
Okay, so Maggie, you've got the microphone now. I don't know. Well, there may be somebody with $35 million burning a hole in their pocket listening. What's the pitch for this movie?
The pitch is that it's like a boy's own story, like Treasure Island, as I just read it again, about we follow this young guy who's a Scotsman. He's the last of the Highlanders, and he's
transported.
He's transported as a slave, essentially, to the New World, where he breaks out and is immediately captured by Indians. And then he becomes a member eventually, after some heroic deeds. He will become a member of this Indian tribe, a woodland Indian, deciding which side they're going to go during the French and Indian War.
Well, so there's action and emotion.
And romance and tattoos. It's good. And it's a perfect part for one of those glorious young English, Irish, Scottish actors.
Well, I hope you guys get a chance to make that movie.
Oh, thanks. You'll love it.
I will love it when I see it. Thank you very much, both of you, John Sayles and Maggie Renzi.
Thanks.
John Sayles and Maggie Renzi are guests of honor at this weekend's Port Townsend Film Festival.